Case number 23-3019, United States of America versus David Floyd, appellant. Ms. Amato for the appellant, Ms. Kelly for the appellate.
Good morning, Ms. Amato.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. On behalf of Mr. Floyd, we assert that his trial counsel at the district court level was ineffective during the plea negotiation phase by agreeing to an enhancement, which was part of the ultimately the plea agreement, which was signed and agreed to. He was ineffective in the negotiation, in informing the client, the defendant, Mr. Floyd at that time, that this was an appropriate plea agreement. And Mr. Floyd, in this case, was charged, as the court is aware, with one count of drug conspiracy. But as part of the guideline calculations, as part of the plea agreement, the parties agreed to a two-level upward adjustment under 2D1.1B1, otherwise known as the gun enhancement. We assert—
Did the parties agree to that? I mean, Mr. Floyd's counsel reserved the right to argue that it was not applicable, right?
Did not. The parties agreed that the application of the guidelines would start out with a drug offense level, which they agreed to, and then also to the two-level points upward for the 2D1.1B enhancement. So this was not a plea where the parties agreed to disagree. This was a plea where both parties agreed to that. And so therefore, if later on defense counsel tried to object to it, it would have been a breach of the plea. And so therein lies the issue and the ineffectiveness in agreeing straight out in the plea agreement that the application applied, the enhancement applied. And submit that under the Strickland prong, the first prong, that it was that trial counsel's conduct fell below an objective standard of reasonableness.
How are we to interpret the reservation of allocution section of the plea agreement that said that the parties could address the correctness of any guidelines calculation by this pre-sentence report, writer or the court?
Right.
And even so, if those calculations differed from the estimated guidelines range in the plea agreement.
So that's a different scenario from what they could object to relative to the plea agreement. The plea agreement, the parties have agreed that this is the framework, drug offense level plus the 2 points for the enhancement. Now, if the pre-sentence report writer came back with some other enhancements, then the parties could have disagreed and objected to those additional enhancements. But as to the enhancement of the 2D1.1B1, which was part of the plea agreement, the defense could not at that point object because it was part of the plea agreement. So the pre-sentence report, if they came up with additional enhancements, that was something the defense reserved the right to object to. But that's not what happened here. It wasn't that the pre-sentence report just came up with an additional enhancement. The enhancement was part of the plea agreement. And so that's the issue here because that enhancement did not apply.
The commentary for the guidelines in lots of cases in this and other courts talk about the fact that guns and drugs go together. And that's, in fact, the reason why the enhancement is in the guidelines. So it seems to me that for you to prevail on your deficiency argument, you have to show that in this case, it was completely unreasonable for his lawyer to agree that drugs and guns could go together in this case.
Excuse me. This circuit has found that there needs to be a nexus between the guns and the drugs. In the case of U.S. versus Miller, 890 F3rd 317, D.C. Circuit case of 2019. And here we have no nexus between the guns and the drug conspiracy. What we have here, the statement of facts points out, basically puts out what the facts are in this case. On January 19th, we have Mr. Floyd and his brother traveling from the United States down to St. Thomas. The next day, January 20th of 2021, Mr. Floyd and his brother go to the post office in St. Thomas, and they seek to mail two packages of the cocaine, the drugs, from St. Thomas. The packages are intercepted by law enforcement. Ultimately, there's a controlled delivery of these drugs on January 29th, 2021, to an address in Bladensburg Road, D.C. The brother of Mr. Floyd is present. He receives the drugs. He's arrested. A month and a half later, on March 12th, is when Mr. Floyd then seeks to send the two weapons, which are part of this 2D1.1B1 enhancement, but not back to St. Thomas. He's trying to send them to St. Martin. So you've got this 1.5 month time period, but regardless from when the drugs were being sent from St. Thomas to the United States, but even if it was the next day, there's no nexus here in the statement of facts that were presented to the court or at any point in any of the arguments in the plea hearing or the transcript that tied those guns that were Mr. Floyd tried to send to St. Martin to the drugs. The plea paperwork and the statement of facts then goes on to jumps to October 7th, some 6-7 months later, in which a wiretap is requested by law enforcement of Mr. Floyd's phone for a 30-day period. Based on that, it's determined that Mr. Floyd is still selling drugs. Then there's a search warrant on November 10th, and then he's arrested. But those guns that he tries to ship on March 12th, I mean, there's no connection whatsoever. And
but there's guns that are found when they arrest him, right, at his residence or a residence that he's connected to.
There is a gun that's found at the residence that he's connected to. He's not arrested there. So the question is whether there's constructive possession. What's interesting, though,
and the guns are next to scales and a bunch of other drug paraphernalia.
Correct. But what's interesting about that gun and this is the government was very specific in their statement of facts as to what gun applied to the 2D1.1B enhancement. And although they mention in the section, which is section number one for the drug conspiracy, that weapon that's found at that other location, they never mention it in the section for the 2D1.1B1. And I have to think, well, why is that? And I believe that
is there a requirement? That they some sort of specificity requirement that they mention a particular gun as a basis for that enhancement in either in the plea agreement or indictment or.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there should be, because how can the court then ascertain whether or not the enhancement applies?
I understand you say there should be, but right. What authority is there that there is such a requirement?
Well, I believe the guidelines require there to be, I mean, for this to come into play, how would one be able to bring it into play if one just...
At sentencing... You know, as you're well aware, the government brings up all sorts of things, some things that aren't charged, some things that aren't even in the statement of offense at all, right? And they can be used to, as part of the guidelines calculation.
Certainly.
We've never, at least I'm not aware of a case where we've said that you can't do that because that wasn't set forth at the time of the plea.
Certainly. But I would say in this particular case, because they were so specific as to which gun applied, that the government at the trial level didn't feel that they had enough evidence as well to tie that other gun in that residence. Although they indicate that Mr. Floyd was connected to that residence, they don't indicate that his name was on the lease, which would mean that there were other people connected to that residence. There's nothing in the plea agreement in which it's definitive that Mr. Floyd agreed that he possessed that weapon. So I believe the government had several hurdles. There was no DNA evidence in the record that tied him to that gun. There was no fingerprint evidence that tied him to that gun. So I believe in the record, the government felt that they had an issue being able to put that forth as an enhancement, and therefore they never brought it forth to argue that that would have been another enhancement that they could have presented in support.
He gave up a litigable issue on the enhancement. in return for that, he got all sorts of benefits. They didn't prosecute on the ghost gun. They didn't seek the mandatory minimum of 10 years. They didn't prosecute him for being a felon in possession. Sounds like a pretty good deal.
Well, I mean, he was charged in one count. For the government to have brought additional counts, that would have required more work. And for the government, might have been just as happy to try to negotiate this so they wouldn't have to do that additional work.
All right, we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Kelly. May it please the court, Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, I would like to point out, just in addition to the points the court had made, linking the gun as a proper reason for the gun enhancement in this case, there was also, in this situation, Mr. Floyd has shown no prejudice that would show that his counsel was ineffective. As the court had just pointed out, there were the plea agreement freed him from numerous other convictions or potential convictions. He had the potential, without the plea agreement, to be sentenced to a mandatory minimum of 10 years rather than the mandatory minimum of 5 years that was placed in the plea agreement terms. He received 3 points, excuse me, for the early acceptance of responsibility by pleading guilty. It freed him also from prosecution separately under 922G for the gun he used at the Maryland firing range during the conspiracy. The guns he mailed to St. Martin as he possessed them in the District of Columbia while he was mailing them on March 12th.
Why didn't the government indict those in the first place if this was such a big deal? I mean, he didn't have to negotiate anything away with respect to that because the government didn't indict it in the first place.
The government, in regard to the guns specifically sent to St. Martin?
Yeah.
Your Honor? Well, the government certainly could have charged that as a separate 922G offense. As during the plea bargaining, they chose not to. And they also could have charged the Glock that was found in the W Street apartment.
I understand that, Well, there's two aspects of this. The first aspect is that you say that there's no prejudice because all of those things could have been charged, but the government could have charged those all along, and they never did. The case was pending for over a year before the plea agreement was reached, if I remember correctly.
It had been pending, Your Honor, but my understanding of the plea negotiations is that those were also ongoing over the course of time. And I believe he had three attorneys. So this was something that was ongoing. But there is no reason why the government couldn't have charged those. And particularly in regard to what defense counsel said about the gun at the W Street apartment, there are strong links of Mr. Floyd to that apartment. Number one, he rented that apartment. He also visited it almost daily before going to his mother's house where he dealt and distributed drugs. Mr. Floyd's passport was found there along with, I believe, a digital scale, $28,500, and the Glock 9mm gun, which was loaded. So there are very strong ties to the W Street apartment and Mr. Floyd and drug dealing. That's at pages 64 and 65 of the public record in this case.
Let me ask you about how we're supposed to view prejudice. Why isn't the prejudice prism the prism of sentencing as opposed to what he could have been charged with had the plea agreement not gone forward? I mean, his claim is that this one specific sentencing enhancement shouldn't have been agreed to. And if it hadn't have been, then he could have gotten, he would have started with a different guidelines range, which presumptively would have benefited him because that would be, you know, kind of the starting point, so to speak, in sentencing. So why isn't that the correct prism to look at the prejudice?
Because when you're looking at a defendant who has claimed that the prejudice is arising from his attorney's allegedly deficient performance during plea negotiations, the remedy for any potential deficient performance by his counsel is not simply just to take away a plea provision, or rather a sentencing provision that he doesn't like. You don't take away a term of the plea agreement. You have to look at the prejudice standard that applies in that situation, which is whether or not, but for counsel's allegedly deficient performance, the defendant would have, there's a reasonable probability that Mr. Floyd would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. And Mr. Floyd has not met that burden here at all. In fact, he has not asserted, in fact, has been insistent that he wanted to enter his plea agreement. And in fact, he wanted to keep his plea agreement, even when he was complaining about the gun enhancement at the hearing right before his sentencing. So for those reasons, he has not ever met the standard that actually applies to alleged deficiency during plea negotiations. And again, going to the prejudice, the court has been clear in United States versus Scanlon that neither this court nor the district court can modify or amend a plea agreement. So what Mr. Floyd is really asking for here is for this court to remove the gun enhancement sentencing provision that he now doesn't like in his plea agreement. That's just not a possibility. That remedy is just simply inappropriate. And again, when you look at the prejudice, the facts don't support prejudice, even if you used Mr. Floyd's inaccurate prejudice analysis.
So let me ask you this. Suppose a defense lawyer agrees in a plea agreement to a sentencing enhancement that is, when we look at it now, was just patently not applicable. Assume that fact for the hypothetical. Are you saying that on review, the question is whether had the lawyer properly advised the defendant and not agreed to that, the question is whether the defendant known that would have gone to trial?
Yes, we believe that is the standard.
So why is that the standard in a situation where a reasonably competent lawyer would never have agreed to that enhancement because it doesn't apply? We would find that to be deficient performance. And wouldn't we say, well, we don't know, we can't say that there was no prejudice because the government might agree to a plea agreement without this illegal enhancement, even if the defendant didn't really want to go to trial. The government didn't want to go to trial either. That's why they entered into a plea agreement.
Well, I think another way that prejudice standard has been put is to that the remedy for an unknowing and involuntary plea agreement would be to permit the defendant to withdraw his guilty plea and return the parties to the negotiating table. So stated that way, the point really is to unwind the plea agreement if there's a problem with the plea agreement. That doesn't necessarily mean that the government then absolutely has to take him to trial. If there is a way to negotiate another plea agreement that's favorable to both sides, the parties are still available to do that.
But that's precisely my point. So why then isn't that really the prism that we're looking at, and not necessarily that there has to be a showing that the defendant intended to or would go to trial if the plea agreement were unwound?
I think that either wording can be used. I believe I've seen that in different cases, that the wording can be used in that regard as well. There is a point, though, that we pointed out in the Lafler versus Cooper cases, that the remedy has to neutralize the taint of whatever constitutional violation is at play, but it can't grant a windfall to the defendant. And what the defendant is asking for here is just to simply have this court remove what he now sees as an objectionable part of his plea agreement and then continue on to sentencing as if that provision didn't become part of the plea agreement in the first place. And that's the part that we think is inappropriate. What could have been done in this case is that the government could have substituted the gun found at W Street for the guns mailed to St. Martin if that became too objectionable in future plea negotiations. Because it sounds like Mr. Floyd, from what he told the court at just before his sentencing hearing, is he did want to keep the plea agreement. But our point is you can't just simply excise part of the plea agreement that you don't like, because that is a windfall to the defendant. All the terms of the plea agreement have to be renegotiated. It can't just be a matter of picking and choosing at the time of sentencing which provisions of the plea agreement that you fairly negotiated, mind you, with counsel that the district court found to be effective and found to have well represented Mr. Floyd in this case. So particularly here where the district court has heard from Mr. Floyd and his counsel, we think it would be particularly inappropriate to simply excise that term of the plea agreement that he now disagrees with.
So. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Motto, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And I wanted to point out that this isn't a case where Mr. Floyd is trying to receive some type of a windfall. During the plea hearing, he actually brought up to the court when the parties put on the record what the plea agreement was. And the parties put on the record the drug offense as well as the 2D1.1B1 enhancement. And when he was asked about those guidelines, he lodged an objection and said he didn't agree with those, that they were incorrect. And we know that he didn't really understand or wasn't given full clarity relative to the guidelines, because then later on in the plea hearing, the judge asked him if he had spoken with his counsel about sentencing and how the sentencing worked, and he said no, and then a recess was taken. Unfortunately, the issue wasn't cured at that point, because the judge didn't come back then and ask him specifically, have your issues with the guideline points been resolved, and also to clarify what those issues were. So Mr. Floyd sought at that point to lodge an objection to the guidelines. Basically, it didn't go anywhere. It wasn't cured. And then at sentencing, after he then had the time further to review the pre-sentence report and see most definitely that those guidelines were there and the enhancement was there, that then he brought up the whole ineffective assistance claim and went from there. So
suppose we were to agree with you. What is the remedy you think that we should give you or your client?
Well, I mean, of course, Mr. Floyd is asking for resentencing without the enhancement.
What authority is there for that remedy?
Well, looking at the U.S. versus Thomas case in this before this circuit, in which this court did specifically find that. That if a defendant can show a reasonable probability that the end result of the criminal process would have been more favorable by reason of a plea to a lesser charge or a sentence of less prison time, that he is satisfied that prejudicial prong. I mean, we know that he, in terms of the plea, he didn't want to plead with those 2 points. We don't have on the record, though, whether if it's a question of either this plea or going to trial, which he would have chosen. That's not in the record. We just know that he was seeking a plea without these 2 points. And so his remedy ultimately is to be resentenced without.
Gives you all of the benefits of your bargain with none of the corresponding burdens.
Well, again, I mean, he had brought the issue up to the court during the plea hearing. It wasn't cured. And I guess that's where we're at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Amato, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Floyd in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is submitted.